TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Amira Haas, Thoughts About Suicide Bombers and Their Families. Amira Haas is the only Jewish-Israeli correspondent on Palestinian affairs who's living among the people she reports on. For the last 10 years, she has lived in the Gaza Strip and now in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. She writes for the large daily newspaper Haaretz. Her integrity and careful reporting have brought her a huge international audience. She also has seriously antagonized both the Israeli and even the Palestinian leadership by her criticism of their actions and strategies. Her report on suicide bombers in the first part of her talk was intensely personal, based on direct contact with families and friends. Some of them are her neighbors. Now she describes the external circumstances that lead youngsters to take this terrible step, the feeling of utter powerlessness, anger, and despair after decades of brutal occupation. Here is Amira Haas.
What I've observed during these years is indeed that there is this collective and personal sensation or feeling of terrible impotence vis-a-vis Israeli might. Terrible impotence vis-a-vis this global injustice that Israel is inflicting on them, that's how they feel, with policies of colonization, with the policy of no freedom of movement, with the policy of restrictions on use of water, etc., etc., disregarding the fact that the peace negotiations haven't led to peace or independence. And then also a lot of anger that the world is indifferent, a lot of anger that the world pays attention to any suicide attack which causes the death, which kills and murders 15 Jews or 20 Jews or 5 Israelis and Jews, but nobody really pays attention when 3 Palestinians are getting killed today and 3 others tomorrow and 5 others in the coming 3 days, and bit by bit. And one is a child, and one is a man and in his 50s, and one is a shepherd, and one is a farmer, and one is a shopkeeper, and one is this, and one is that, and they're all civilians. But it goes, that's what they feel, it goes unnoticed. They are taking revenge here of all the Palestinian death. And, you know, out of the 2,500 or so Palestinian casualties till today, you know, it's very difficult to exactly measure how many of them were civilians, but I would say no less than 60% were civilians, no less. And many of those who were policemen and were killed were not killed in battle, but they were killed while they were in their positions, posts in the West Bank and Gaza, and they were killed by Israeli soldiers only because they had arms, but they did not initiate any battle. There are about 400 children who were killed. There are about 200 women who were killed. So these people, seeing this and making the measurements, and they want revenge, for sure. So the moment, what I've discovered with all my in all my talks, is the moment of omnipotence for these people. One moment of omnipotence. It's an illusion, of course. One moment of omnipotence which pays back to this long history and long future which is awaiting them of impotence. Now, they all have participated in funerals of others who have died, were killed or killed themselves and killed others. So they can imagine how their own funeral would look like. So, you know, it's like the children who are angry with their parents and they go up and they say, I wish I died and then I will see my parents now sorry for my death. So they can really portray their own funeral and they can really feel how people will miss them and love them and cherish them and see them as heroes. They can do it because they've participated in so many funerals, as one of the people told me, at the beginning of the Intifada, once stopped knowing in whose funeral you are. Maybe it's your own funeral. There are so many funerals every day. Another way of me to get very close to this issue of to these suicide bombers or would-be was through three interviews smuggled to me out of prison, out of Israeli prison. They were done by an Israeli-Palestinian prisoner who had been already for 18 years in jail. He was involved with a Palestinian Popular Front some 20 years ago and was caught and sentenced to life, even though he claims he was not involved in what he was charged with. But he met several youngsters from the northern West Bank who failed in their attempt to commit suicide. They were caught beforehand. And he wanted to understand this phenomenon because he had not known it about Palestinian society. He knew that then when they were fighting 15 years ago, they were fighting for life, not for death. He didn't understand this phenomenon when these youngsters, 19 years old, who yesterday was supposed to be shaheed, now is complaining that at the shop of the jail, he could not find gel to his hair. So that tragic, he said, there is something, I don't understand this. So he started to interview them, three of them, and he also wanted to penetrate through the slogans they were already disseminating because they were already adopted by their groups in jail, and then when you are adopted, you start to give, to recite the version, the official version of the group. Yes, I go because of heaven and because of God and because of this. And one guy that in the official, more or less official interview, kept telling him that he was doing this for religious reasons. This one guy had the daily stroll with him one day in the courtyard of jail, of prison, and he told him, you know, and this guy could have been, this prisoner could have been their father. So he told him, the first time that Jenin camp was invaded by the Israeli army and there was curfew, nobody could leave the house for 3 days. Then I looked up from the window and I saw a dog going out from one of the houses and passing by the soldiers, and nothing happened to the dog. So that's when I decided to go and commit suicide, because if the life of a dog worth more than our life, then what should I do? But this, he told him, this simple story of a dog. But still, I think that it will be incorrect to say, to dismiss completely the religious aspect of it. In 96 and 94 suicide attacks, mostly perpetrated by Hamas people, certainly, and this is also what some of these interviewees said, the ideological religious element was very strong. The belief that heaven is waiting and that there is that while what you are doing, you are helping in liberating Palestine. No real, there was a great belief in this. Now it's much less. Now it's the people who are being recruited are much less motivated by this religious ideology. But still, most of them, as I've learned, in the few months or weeks before the attack, are becoming very, very observant. They go five times to the mosque. They pray. They try to behave better. If they drank before, they stop drinking alcohol. They try to be more polite with their parents. This I've learned from several cases. Now, this is also a reason for the family to be very fearful. If they see that their child is becoming more observant, I meant mostly about going to mosque and becoming very, very orthodox, if I can use this term here, then it might be a sign that he has decided to commit suicide. The Palestinian security organizations have received during the last 2 years or so several warnings by families that suspected their children are going to commit suicide. Right now, they are in Jericho prison, four youngsters from Jenin area who are arrested because of information given by their family. The family preferred them to be arrested than to commit suicide. I was told by a Palestinian security officer that he himself, a year ago, was told, or some month ago, by families in the Nablus area, that they know that there are four women students, very successful women students, who decided to commit suicide. He found them, he located them in a flat somewhere near Jerusalem. He had the hard work at convincing them or dissuading them. They had everything prepared. They wanted to go with Hamas. Hamas didn't want. They went with Jihad or Fatah. Now I don't remember. But he managed to dissuade them. So this is in as contrast to the general belief that Palestinian families are happy with their children going to heaven in such a way. This is all true on the personal and family level. This explaining on the background of occupation, not only the immediate occupation of today and of the need to revenge for a chain of civilians getting killed by Israeli soldiers, of endless Israeli assaults, etc. But all this accumulation of the last 36 years of Israeli occupation, which have made Palestinians lose all belief in a possible future, decent future for themselves and for their community and for their children. This is good for us to understand the personal motivations, I think, to understand of individuals. But there is here another dimension, a dimension of organizations, and the organizations which send those people. And this will be the last part of my talk before we start the questions. Now, Hamas were the first ones to use, in this intifada, to use suicide bombers. Then Jihad followed suit. Then Popular Front, secular Popular Front, sent someone who killed himself and maybe wounded two or three soldiers in Gaza Strip. And this was after the head of the Popular Front was assassinated by Israel. And then Fatah started to launch their live bombs after a leader of Shuhada al-Aqsa was assassinated in November 2001. This organization certainly find it very easy to recruit suicide bombers. If I said before that one needs only 5 minutes in order to find to convince someone to commit suicide, I think that very often there are so many candidates for suicide bombings that some activists of some organizations had to send them away and to say no. And I have read some affidavits of youngsters who wanted to commit suicide. They met the person in charge in their camp or whatever who refused because of their young age. And I've seen some other affidavits that young children were recruited very easily by very careless, irresponsible mobilizers in this neighborhood. Now the question is, how come all these organizations are using this weapon? And how come they have not used it from the start of the Intifada? I think that for the Islamic Jihad, which is a very small organization, by the way, when it was established as part of the Islamic Brothers in the early 80s, they made it clear that their target should be only soldiers and no civilians. I think that they opt for some sort of chaos. Because they are so small, they don't have any responsibility for a mass population. So they don't have a real huge constituency. Their real constituency is, I guess, some international Islamic, radical Islamic group. Some say Iran. I don't know. But they certainly build, in their ideology, build on creating chaos in the area. Chaos which will bring to the end of Israel. And this I say from, based on talks that I've led with activists of Islamic Jihad before some years, and some readings. Now with Hamas is more complicated. Hamas, of course, at the end believed that Palestine would be a Muslim state from the sea to the river. maybe Jews would be allowed to stay there, maybe not, I don't know, but eventually this will happen. Now, I'm sorry some of you have heard me saying this vitz, but the difference between moderates and extremist Hamas people is that the extremists think this can happen, this Islamic Palestinian state can happen in 50 years. The moderates think it will happen in 500 years. Now, the number of moderates has decreased during the last 3 years. And I think that more people believe that if you create this chaos, you bring this solution or whatever you call it faster. This is one way to understand it. Another way to understand it is that Hamas, as a political power which represents a big chunk of Palestinian society, is always acting, is always very attendant to people's moods. And they have read at a certain moment that Palestinians are fed up with this imbalance of victims in this intifada. Now, the beginning of this intifada was seen as a victory, actually, or of the PLO organizations taking the premiership, if I can call this so, in the struggle for liberation, after, for years, PLO and especially Fatah were taken as just a backbone and a poodle of the Palestinian Authority. And all of a sudden, with this intifada, which started by some activists, young activists of Fatah, Fatah was seen again as, okay, we are leading the struggle for real independence, not anybody else. In a strange way, people were counting the number of victims who belong to each organization. And the victims who belong to each organization means those who went to the checkpoints and were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles or Israeli soldiers. So Fatah was the winning party here. Then Hamas, at the beginning of this intifada, Hamas was very suspicious with Fatah and Arafat's motives. They believed that this was only a bargaining chip on the part of that what Arafat was opting for is better cards in his negotiation with Israel. They didn't believe it was, they believed like Israel, it was all orchestrated by Arafat. But then they saw that the public, general public, was shifting again and supporting more Fatah because it was leading the struggle against Israeli occupation. At the same time, people saw that this leadership of Hamas was leading nowhere, was bringing them nowhere, that all these victims led nowhere, that Israeli opinion, public opinion, hasn't changed, hasn't come to see Israeli occupation as they hoped they would see. On the contrary, Israeli population, Israeli public, saw the intifada as a terrible offense and a terrible insult after the great years of peace, of Oslo. That's how the Israelis saw it. So Hamas, it was very attentive to the people's mood, felt the people's need in revenge. And they responded to this need. So they were not thinking about the strategy of independence and liberation. They were thinking about how to improve their position within the Palestinian internal, political internal arena. This is a long, I think, long, old characteristics of Palestinian political scene, that every Palestinian organization has adopted tactics vis-à-vis Israel since the 60s or 70s, not after carefully calculating what is really bringing them closer to liberation, but how it will improve the popularity, the internal popularity within the Palestinian population. This is not something I've invented. I've learned it from Palestinian colleagues and Palestinian observers. I must stress this. And then, of course, I forgot, then when Hamas started, then Fatah felt they are losing this competition, and they started to adopt this method as well. Out of impotence, out of weakness, everything, but aiming to improve their internal position. And I heard it. I had this argument, sort of, with one Fatah leader, And I said, how can you call this war of liberation when you send a youngster to kill people in a restaurant or whatever it was? And he said, we have to prove to the people that we can also have revenge for our dead. So, in a nutshell, Palestinian organizations have used, abused, consumed the need of so many youngsters, Palestinian youngsters, and individuals, their need in revenge, the society's need in revenge, these youngsters' readiness to kill themselves out of collective despair, not necessarily personal despair. So they have been using it out of their own impotence of those organizations and lack of unified strategy. I think it is letting the Palestinian leadership of the Oslo years to get away with their responsibility of cooperating or collaborating too long with this deception of a peace process. I think there were margins of maneuver of the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leaderships and organizations during the last 10 years. Enough margins of nothing is deterministic in history, I don't believe. I mean, people have still, and organizations still have the power to change some things, even when they are facing terribly mighty powers. And I think in those years, if they had been more attentive to the people, if they were not so entrenched in old habits of hierarchy within the Palestinian society and in safeguarding their privileged positions, if they were very insistent on the issue of settlements, they would have been able to get much more than allowing these suicide bombers, youngsters, who had been neglected. It's youngsters who had been neglected by the Palestinian Authority during the years of Oslo. Look, the fact is that the number of Israeli settlers has increased during the last 3 years. Many have not been deterred by the present situation and the clashes. The suicide attacks inside Israel have completely blurred the difference between settlers and Israelis in Israel. So it motivated the Israeli army to permanently improve the methods and means of safeguarding settler security. So the fence in many places is built in order to secure to guarantee their security. There are fences around the settlements. There are special rules of engagement that allow the army to shoot at any person nearing any settlement. So in a way, the last 3 years have seen an improvement in the logistics of defense of Israeli settlements. And this is why many settlers feel very encouraged to go and live there. A different Palestinian strategy during the years of Oslo, I think, could have rallied many more Israelis or made many more Israelis understand the reality that the Israeli government was trying to impose. The main weapon in Israeli hands during the years of Oslo was the alienation of Palestinian leadership from its own people. That's how I see it. Israel, in the disguise of a peace process, continued the occupation and the colonization. But the Palestinian leadership cooperated with this. Now, I don't say that this is the reason why it continued. You know, when they could pay decent salaries to teachers, but not invest so much money in economical monopolies, which were benefiting only a few people of the Palestinian Authority, I think they would have had the people with them. And then at the same time, if they stopped negotiations with Israel and said, we don't negotiate as long as you have another house built in the occupied territories, they would have drawn the attention of the world. But they continued. But they really continued all the time to speak up with Israelis. and getting their privileges to go around. So believe me, I know there has been an Israeli clear plan to bring into a Palestinian surrender. There was the plan. The plan has not changed. But still there was... the Palestinians did not come in 93 only as defeated. They also came in a time in a world which was backing the idea of a two-state solution, an end of occupation. Now I say there is a problem. I mean, I think that the problem with the European collaboration with this myth of Oslo was very disastrous. I'm not mentioning American. You know, I think that we don't do justice to Palestinians if we only think of them in terms of victims and victimologies and do not believe that they have power in their hands to change. I think it is wrong about any people in struggle against oppression and also about Palestinians. Because what there is multiplicity of strategies, if it's not an oxymoron. Because when you have multiplicity of strategies, it means that there is no one leadership that is learning what is best in the struggle for independence. Thank you.
You heard the conclusion of a one-hour talk by the Israeli journalist and author Amira Haas. Amira Haas was born in Israel as the daughter of Holocaust survivors. She is fearless in her daily life in the city of Ramallah under Israeli occupation and unafraid to criticize the Palestinian Authority or the Israeli government. Amira Haas wrote two books about her 10-year residence in occupied Palestine. Reporting from Ramallah, an Israeli journalist in an occupied land, and Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege. She spoke at the University of California, Berkeley in October 2003 about suicide bombers and their families. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Amira Haas on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete talk by Amira Haas on suicide bombers by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.